welcome to Irreligiosity. This is our continued attempt to lose any listeners that we may have gained over the last 2-3 months.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's much like the LDS Church in and of itself. We have a tendency of putting you to sleep while discussing such topics.
And here we go. What do we got on tap for today?
What I was planning on doing, Nez, for today is bringing up a lot of the issues that the LDS Church either hides from its users or just outright ignores and calls it Mormon propaganda. Now, the LDS Church, I mean, to give you an idea of how big Joseph Smith is in the LDS Church, my dad, on several occasions, and the last one being just a few months ago, sat me down and told me that other than Jesus Christ himself, Joseph Smith is the only other person to bring about more souls to God.
That is actually, I believe, in the Doctrine and Covenants.
Oh, is it?
I believe it's in the section where they detail his martyrdom. Yeah, so it's section 135 of the Doctrine and Covenants, verse 3. Joseph Smith, the prophet and seer of the Lord, has done more, save Jesus only, for the salvation of men in this world than any other man that ever lived in it.
The only reason why Charlie knows that is because the Doctrine and Covenants bores the shit out of me. In fact, I have never, ever been able to get more than a few chapters into it.
Yeah, it's a series of revelations, put that in quotes, given to Joseph Smith. And it was actually a full year. It was like Church History, Doctrine and Covenants in seminary. And that was, unfortunately, one of the years that I got. I would rather have gotten the Book of Mormon. That was the one I skipped. But I got Church History, Doctrine and Covenants. So I actually read the whole thing in there. You probably slept through it.
Yeah, if I would have had it. I mean, like I said, I did go through 3 years of the LDS seminary. And in all honesty, I can't even remember what books were studied. That's how much I slept through or just plain skipped.
How'd you get out of the fourth?
That was because I skipped that grade to get into high school early.
I see.
Yeah. So, there's absolutely no way I would have got out of the fourth otherwise because, I mean, as described in my deconversion story, my family was extremely religious.
Yeah. Layton has done a bunch of research, and I've done a bunch of research. So what we're going to do is present Layton's findings first, and then we'll go over to mine. Mine is on Adam God. And that is, I think, fatal to Mormonism because there is no good explanation for it.
Well, there's no good explanation for half of this stuff that comes up. I mean, seriously, the LDS Church tosses out all sorts of answers. But when you get down to it and you actually read and start researching some of this, there's absolutely no way around it unless you just want to close your eyes and pretend that it's not there.
All right, so let's do yours. What do you got?
Well, I wanted to start with Joseph Smith and how he came to be the prophet. Now,
that's simple. Sacred Grove. God and Jesus appeared to him.
Very true.
And Moroni appeared to him a couple years later.
Uh-huh.
There you go. He's a prophet.
All right, well, all that happened within the 4 to 5 years before the Book of Mormon was actually published, correct?
Yeah, that would be 18 teens or early 20s, I think.
All right, so what happens if 4 years before the Book of Mormon is actually published, Joseph Smith is arrested for running a money scam where he has these seer stones and he's trying to get people's money? They actually called him Joseph Smith the Glass Looker, arrested and charged on March 20th, 1826, and he was forced to pay a fine of $2.68.
Which seems cheap, but in those days, it was more like probably $100, right?
Yeah.
Which is very interesting because my parents told me Joseph Smith was arrested many times, but it was only because Satan was persecuting the Lord's chosen, right?
Yeah.
And you could tell this because he was arrested many times and tried, but he was never convicted.
Yeah, and right here you can actually look up Justice Albert Neely's transcripts, and you can see that Joseph Smith was not only arrested, but he was charged. And right above him, Samuel May on March 22, 1826. So, I mean, you can see him right in the center there actually being arrested for using these same seer stones that supposedly he used to translate the Book of Mormon.
It's interesting. he got a fee of $2.68. That was his penalty. Assault and battery apparently is less of a crime than glass looking because he only got fined $1.99.
That's very true. Maybe they figured because Joseph Smith was going after other people's money, they should fine him.
It would have been cheaper for Joseph Smith to just beat the crap out of him.
Yeah, yeah, I think I think that's very true, but maybe Joseph Smith wasn't wise enough to that, or he wasn't as strong.
I'll tell you what happened was that he had the Urim and Thummim in his possession at this time, and he was just using it to gain some money to fund the publication of the Book of Mormon.
Oh, of course, because raping a family of its money wasn't good enough, so he was just trying to make some extra cash.
We haven't gotten to Martin Harris yet.
Not yet. Oh, so you're saying that God actually wanted Joseph Smith to go out there and make money any way he possibly could to get this Book of Mormon out there.
God works in mysterious ways, Leighton.
Oh, of course. All right, well, a lot of people, especially those in the LDS religion, actually envision Joseph Smith sitting down with this nice suit on with a quill pen in his hand, and right next to him are the golden plates, and of course the Urim and Thummim, and the breastplate, the sword, I mean various paintings of Joseph Smith, all of them with the golden plates right in front of him.
There's an actual description, I think, about it being a breastplate with a set of glasses hooked onto it, and that was the Urim and Thummim?
Yeah, it's very convoluted as to what the Urim and Thummim actually look like. And later on, I found one source, I don't remember who it was, but they stated that the seer stones that Joseph Smith were actually donated back to the church some years ago, I think late 1800s or so.
Really?
Yeah.
I'd like to get my hands on those.
Wouldn't it be nice to get down to that legendary vault that the LDS Church has? Well, anyway, so I'd like to read from you something by David Whitmer. And this is, it's called An Address to All Believers in Christ, page 12, given on 1887. I will now give you a description of the manner in which the Book of Mormon was translated. Joseph would put the seer stone into a hat and put his face in the hat, drawing it closely around his face to exclude the light. And in the darkness the spiritual light would shine. A piece of something resembling parchment would appear, and on that appeared the writing. One character at a time would appear, and under it was the interpretation in English. Thus the Book of Mormon was translated by the gift and power of God, and not by any power of man.
Well, apparently, in that case, Reformed Egyptian is a cipher of English, because one character at a time would pop up, and then one character of English at a time would pop up, right?
Exactly. I mean,
is that what we're talking about?
That's
a cipher. It's ridiculous.
That's what he just is stated, exactly. And I'm pretty sure the Egyptian hieroglyphs work the same way, don't they?
Absolutely.
Of course. It has nothing to do with tones.
It's not phonetic at all. It's just a simple cipher that, you know, it's kind of like a proto-English, I guess.
Yeah. Now listen to this quote. It was actually in an interview given to the Kansas City Journal on June 5th, 1881. I, as well as all of my father's family, Smith's wife, Oliver Cowdery, and Martin Harris were present during the translation. He, Joseph Smith, did not use the plates in translation.
Come on. If that's the case, why would he need to dig up the place in the first place?
See, that is actually something very interesting because I believe it was Martin Harris. Have you heard about how Martin Harris and Joseph Smith walked into the Hill of Cumorah and around them was abundant bits of gold?
I've heard about that. They walked into a cave in the Hill of Cumorah. And it was like this collection of all Native American
swords
Nephi.
With inscriptions on it and such. And it's the same thing. It begs to wonder if Joseph Smith didn't even need the golden plates to be there while he translated, why would God even have him pull it out of the mountain?
Right. If they were safe there for thousands of years, why not just grab the seer stones?
Yeah. Stick your face in a hat, see what happened thousands of years ago. Sure, it makes sense to me.
Why did Moroni need the seer stones in the first place? He was burying it. Apparently he wrote in Reformed Egyptian. Why would he need a Urim and Thummim in the first place?
Because God could foresee that we would forget about Reformed Egyptian.
Oh, God.
And that there would be absolutely no record whatsoever of it in any history.
this story just gets, the more you look into it, the more ludicrous. I mean, it's ludicrous on the face of it, but the more you look into it, the more ludicrous it becomes.
Yeah, now that's the sad thing about it, is the LDS Church, they really, really play upon the fact that you should not go out and research these varying facets of, of the early history, because it can be convoluted and harmful to your faith. In fact, I'm pretty sure you got that when you went to a bishop concerning some of your concerns.
Yeah, we were discussing Adam God. It actually is one of them, and he said that you shouldn't look too deeply into this stuff. A, because it really doesn't affect your salvation, and B, these are mysteries, and it won't be revealed until all is made public, I guess, or whatever. The end times, I guess. When the kingdom of God has been restored, then you'll know everything.
So basically, close your eyes until the world dies, and then everything will find.
Yeah, it's a recurrent theme in these religions, you know. Don't get yourself educated because, well, smart, educated people just don't believe this crap.
Yeah, for some reason, you know, your education has an effect on your faith. I wonder why.
Yeah.
Well, so the next topic is what is actually written inside of the Book of Mormon. And it's fascinating what you can stumble across, because Joseph Smith, the Book of Mormon is actually writings about these two peoples, the loosely based Lamanites and the Nephites, the constant wars they have with each other, wherein they ride horses into battle. They run across elephants at times.
My God, really?
You didn't know about the elephants?
I don't remember that, no.
Yeah, there are elephants. You can actually discover elephants. And it's kind of funny, because I read an argument where a Mormon philosopher was stating that these elephants were probably mammoths still left over from that period. However, mammoths died out in 11,000 BC, if I'm not mistaken. So
No, you're mistaken, because weren't they in that show 10,000 BC?
Ah, shit.
And yes. The pyramids too.
Yes, I'm sure a wonderful display there. So I mean, you have, not only do you have just these animals, I mean, the horse, if not many of you know, the horse was actually introduced by the Europeans. They escaped onto the American continent and then spread across, and that's why we have horses here today.
Right. Pre-Columbus, there are no horses. There are kind of distant relatives of horses that die out in the 10,000s, I think, in the American continent. But there are no horses as we know them. 10,000 years, at least, has gone by since there's anything resembling a horse. The Native Americans and the South Americans had llamas, I think.
Yeah, llamas, so they were, alpacas.
Yeah, they were fascinated by the horses when they came.
Well, who wouldn't be? I mean, you see this magnificent beast running around. So Let me get this. So if there are no horses, then what exactly was used to pull the chariots that Joseph Smith says they had during that time?
Yeah, a little more problematic is that there's no wheels. They had wheels, like the Aztecs and the Incas, I think, had wheels on little toys, but they never kind of scaled up.
Yeah, I believe it was in the 9th century AD before the wheels began to be used in certain societies.
It's amazing.
Yeah, you can actually read about chariots in the Book of Mormon. It's Alma chapter 18, verse 9. So before that, since they didn't have horses, did they just have other people grabbing onto the front there and running in front of these chariots? Was that how they drew them?
They were drawn by the power of God.
Invisible horses, very nice.
I think even funnier is that at the end of Jacob 7, and so we're talking, I'm not sure where this is, but it couldn't be past 400 AD, which is when the Book of Mormon ended.
Yeah.
And I, Jacob, saw that I must soon go down to my grave, blah, 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 blah. And he's talking about the plates. And then he says, at the end of it, he kind of winds up, to the reader I bid farewell, hoping that many of my brethren may read my words. Brethren, adieu.
Comment allez-vous?
Small problem, Joseph. French didn't exist in 400 AD. The language wasn't there.
I'm pretty sure it is. We have proof of it right here. I mean, maybe Reformed Egyptian is a form of French.
Maybe it was pre-French. Proto-French.
Proto-French.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
So, I mean, you just take a look at that, and you have so many difficulties with the actual Book of Mormon. And, I mean, we haven't even really gotten started into some of this. I mean,
we haven't scratched the surface. There's parts of Isaiah, I think, that he copied word for word that were mistakenly translated by the King James.
The King James version, and
that mistake was carried through. Now they'll say, he came upon the Isaiah, and he just from there went on and grabbed the stuff out of his Old Testament and moved it over, ported it over. You know, to which I say, come on, either he's translating or he's not translating. and B, I think that pins the Book of Mormon down as a post 1700s work.
It has to be. I mean, if you were actually copying from another source and you find proof of that copy, then that's exactly what's happening.
Right. It's plagiarized errors. It's proof that it was
it's the whole phone book issue where you insert falsehoods into the phone book to discover what's been copyrighted.
Right. One of the problems I had with the Book of Mormon in general as a kid is that the prophecies in the Old Testament really have to be worked over several times and twisted and kind of brought out of context in order to
fit the situation
into what we think that they're prophesying. In the Book of Mormon, it's awfully specific. They talk about the founding fathers and I think Columbus.
Yes, they do actually.
I mean, even the name Jesus Christ, I think, is foretold on the Americas. And it's like, come on, man. In the Old Testament, they said, you know, he shall be born and his name will be Emmanuel. It's never directly accurate, right? 100% accurate. But the Book of Mormon is, surprisingly. It just seemed to me, even as a kid, it seemed really suspicious. It was just too perfect.
Well, that's just because you don't understand that the Book of Mormon is a more righteous representation of God's works. I mean, the Bible is corrupt, which is why they never were given the name of Jesus.
That's the excuse.
Are you kidding? That's really the excuse?
That's the excuse. The Bible's corrupt. That's why they needed the Book of Mormon. It's what my parents told me.
Oh, you've got to be kidding me. I just pulled that out of my ass.
It's the only pure scripture that we have. It's better than the Bible. It's better than both the Old and the New Testament. It is plain and precious.
Yeah, I don't know how precious it could be when he's copywriting.
Are you kidding? It's the pearl of great price. That's precious.
So many things I could say right now. All right, well, I mean, another thing I'd like to move into is concerning Martin Harris and Professor Anthon. Now, interestingly enough, Martin Harris wrote a letter addressed to Mr. Emerson Sir, and it was dated November 23rd, 1870, and this is what it says. I received your favor. In reply, I will say concerning the plates, I do say that the angel did show to me the plates containing the Book of Mormon. Further, the translation that I carried to Professor Anthon was copied from these same plates, also that the professor did testify to it being a correct translation. Now, this is actually something huge in the LDS Church, talking about how Martin Harris took this example of Joseph Smith's translations. I mean, we're talking symbols that were copied directly out of the golden plates. He took it to Professor Anthon. And Professor Anthon actually stated that these were valid translations. I find that very interesting, considering Egyptian hadn't been fully cracked yet.
The discovery of the Rosetta Stone was in, I think, the 1799 on Napoleon's expedition to Egypt. That helped, but the key, I think, was the Coptic language, because they could tell what it was, but then it just got you the sounds.
Yeah, they weren't exactly.
They didn't know
what
it meant, and Coptic was kind of verbal Egyptian that had passed down. No one could read hieroglyphs, but they still say Coptic. So once you got the phonetics of it, then was it Champollion who?
Champollion finished it in 1841. So we're talking a
three years before Joseph Smith died, and 11 years after the publication of the Book of Mormon. So either Anthon is an amazing expert who was a full decade above
before Champollion, so why is it we're not hearing about him where Egyptologists are concerned?
His place in history was robbed by Champollion, Or Anthon didn't say what Martin Harris thought he said.
I think you might actually have something there where Anthon may not have said that. Now, this is actually something Charlie and I discovered, and this comes directly from Anthon himself. The whole story about my having pronounced the Mormonite inscription to be Reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics is perfectly false. Some years ago, a plain and apparently simple-hearted farmer called upon me. Upon examining the paper in question, I soon came to the conclusion that it was all a trick, perhaps a hoax. On hearing this odd story, I changed my opinion about the paper, and instead of viewing it any longer as a hoax upon the learned, I began to regard it as a part of a scheme to cheat the farmer of his money, and I communicated my suspicions to him, warning him to beware of rogues. Now that sounds a little bit more like what would probably happen.
That sounds right. And if you go on, he talks about he saw the kind of characters and said there were all kinds of crooked characters, disposing columns, evidently been prepared by some person who had before him at the time a book containing various alphabets, Greek and Hebrew letters, crosses and flourishes, Roman letters, inverted or placed sideways. He even had a copy of the Mexican calendar. So here he is, and I can see what happened. Anthon says, well, these are ancient characters, right?
Yeah.
They're
Anthon
Greek, Hebrew. They're, this is a Mexican calendar. This is Roman. But it's a mishmash. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. It's obvious to me that Martin Harris took away from that encounter that Professor Anthon was stating that these were true characters. That's what he took away from it all.
Well, yeah, probably what, or he could have even said, you know, Joseph Smith, he said that that these are ancient characters, but they're not, you know, they're not translatable. You can't translate them. It's a mishmash of all these different languages. And Joseph Smith would have said, ah, but they are ancient characters, right? He did say that. Of course he couldn't translate it because you can only translate this through the power of God.
Yeah.
And then Harris being the simple-minded farmer that he is.
Simple-hearted.
Sorry.
Simple-hearted.
I would say Anthon is wrong in that. He's a simple-minded
farmer. Yeah, I'm going with... I mean, I feel bad for Harris. I mean, he lost his wife over this. He lost his farm over this. I mean, I feel bad for him, but I agree. I think Harris was simple-minded.
So you can kind of see what happened, and I tend to believe Anthon's account over Harris's account. Anthon has no dog in this hunt. He just says that, well, yeah, I think this is a hoax. You're going to get cheated of your money, and guess what? Anthon was more of a prophet than the prophet Joseph Smith.
Yeah, you know, maybe we should all be following Anthon's little prophecies here. I mean, he was absolutely right. He thought it was a hoax. Someone was after his money, and sure enough...
Someone was after his money.
Harris dumps all this money into the Book of Mormon and loses everything.
Yeah.
So, I mean, basically, so that is basically how the Book of Mormon came about. We have Joseph Smith with his seer stones in his hats, completely believable in my opinion. We have chariots, horses, elephants coming out of this. And, I mean, just over and over again, you discover all these little intricacies that make you go, what the hell is going on with this document? I mean, how is this possible? And how is this supposed to be taken as true and literal? So let's move on to polygamy, one of the favorite topics where the LDS Church is concerned. Now, Joseph Smith was the one to start polygamy. In fact, supposedly God had to threaten him with a burning sword in order to take wives. And then he goes and takes, how many wives, Charlie?
Mid-30s, I think 33 or 34 wives.
Yeah, and...
So he sure embraced it.
Yeah, he embraced it full on.
That flaming sword worked.
Not only did he embrace it, but he was marrying other men's wives.
Yeah.
If you go to www.wivesofjosephsmith.org, it actually has a table where it shows not only the wives' names, when they were married, their ages, but also who their husbands were at the time when Joseph Smith married them.
Yeah, and they don't mention, I believe, Parley P. Pratt. Or Heber C. Kimball's wife, Violet, both of whom I believe, Parley Pratt was on a mission when he came back and his wife informed him that Joseph Smith said that, had approached her while he was away and said that, you know, God told me you're supposed to be my wife. And she said, well, I'm already married and I'll wait till Parley gets back. And Parley was absolutely furious over this, and I believe he left the church for a while.
I would hope so.
I believe if he had not left the church, he may have been the second president of the church rather than Brigham Young. I believe he lost his place in the Quorum of the Twelve and went from 1 to 12. I think he lost his place in the Quorum because when he got his membership back, he was the bottom of the pile. And Heber C. Kimball said the same thing. You know, Violet. He approached Violet. Heber C. Kimball's wife said, "God said we were married in the past. You know, existence, blah blah blah." And the Mormon story is that they agonized over it all night long. And unlike Parley in the morning, he said, "This is the hardest thing I've ever had to do. But you can go ahead and have my wife." And Joseph Smith said,
"This was all a test.
This was a test. This day your salvation has been made sure, and you can keep your wife." So that's kind of what they bring up when you bring up polyandry, right? The polygamy or polygyny, where you have multiple wives, isn't so much a problem as the polyandry where you have multiple husbands.
Yeah.
There is no theological basis on that, except for Joseph Smith saying that, they were coincidentally married to me before.
Yeah.
So they're actually my wife.
Yeah, you know, in the pre-existence, before I came to this world, those were all my wives. I'd like them back now.
Yeah, interestingly enough, the marriages began as early as 1827. That was 3 years before the publication of the Book of Mormon.
Yes, yes, it was, in fact. And
I wonder what the date is of that revelation of DNC 132. Okay, looking it up, section 132, revelation given through Joseph Smith, the prophet at Nauvoo, Illinois, recorded July 12, 1843, this is a year before he was martyred, relating the new and everlasting covenant, including the eternity of plural marriages, is also plurality of wives. Although the revelation was recorded in 1843, it is evident from the historical records that the doctrines and principles involved in this revelation have been known by the prophet since 1831. But if you look at the website, his first marriage was in 1827, 4 years before that.
Yes, so, ouch.
Yeah, that's a little odd, isn't it?
Yeah.
That and fundamentalist Mormons, really get in trouble because they marry girls that are really young.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And that's one of the big issues, is these girls are too young to make proper decisions.
Absolutely. I don't know if you can consent to being married to like a 40-year-old guy when you're 13, 14 years old. So, and they get that doctrine from Joseph Smith. He married girls as young as 14 and as old as 58.
Yeah, now please explain that one to me. Why would you marry that sort of range? I can understand the young girls. I mean, young, virile women.
You pedophile.
I'm not talking, well, I guess I am talking that young. Okay. Let me go back on what I just said.
Let's rewind that.
Let's rewind that. Just ignore that statement. No, I mean, I can understand marrying or chasing after young tail, as in 18-year-old and older.
Although, in the Old Testament, I believe they married very, very young, but yeah, well, they also died very young,
they
too.
Also died before their ages of 30. I mean, Come on now. But, I mean, seriously, though, I can understand that portion. You're looking at a young woman. It is in man's nature, in and of itself, to spread his seed. And when you see a young, fertile woman, all of us are aroused. We're just men. That's the way it is. But how in the world...
I actually prefer 10-year-old boys myself.
Well, that's just because you like to take them in the showers and slick the hair back and then pretend they're eight.
I did spend some time as a Catholic priest.
Ooh, ouch. If there are any Catholics out there, please start throwing things at the wall.
We've spent most of the program offending Mormons, so I throw a little Catholic jab in there, too.
Well, if we're talking about Catholic jabs, you just remind me of a great joke. So why is it all the altar boy's hair is parted down the middle? Because when they're kneeling before the Catholic priest, he's got his hands on their head, parting the hair, going... That's the way, boy, right there. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Hey, well, if we're offending people, that's the way to do it.
We might have to tag this one as explicit.
Wait, you lost my train of thought. Oh, 58-year-old woman. Now, what exactly is attractive about 58-year-old woman?
Postmenopausal, you can't have any kids by her. No paternity suit.
Sorry for all those over 58. Some of you are attractive. I just can't understand why you would be chosen over a young woman.
There's no polite way to say that.
Yeah, there's really no polite way to say that. When you've got two models in front of you,
we've determined that Leighton is sexist, homophobic, He hates mentally challenged people, and now he's ageist.
I don't hate them. I just like to call them what they are, retards. And all I'm doing is pointing out the truth. I mean, 90% of the men you set in front of you, if you've got a woman 58 and a woman 18, which do you think they're going to go for?
Well, they'll go for the 18-year-old, assuming, you know...
she's good-looking?
Right. Assuming all else is equal, they'll go for the younger one. And the other 10% are lying.
Yeah, I'll agree with it. Maybe the older woman they figure they'll get financial status from.
Aha!
Which could very well be what
it
is.
I've seen plenty of that on Judge Judy.
What are you talking about? Mark Twain always tried to marry rich.
She often... Well, look at the lady, right? And she's this kind of dumpy, middle-aged woman, and this guy's young. He's like in mid-20s, but you can tell he's a total deadbeat. She'll say, why do you think he would want to live with you?
Oh, and that may very well be it. I mean, Joseph Smith was arrested for running a money scam by seeing stones.
Well, plus he's got to support 33 other wives. I mean, my God, that's expensive.
Yeah, well, I mean, you got the young, virile women. You got to find the money
somehow. I would like to look into the financial statement of that 58-year-old.
That is actually a very good point. If anybody out there has those financial statements or the history of that, I would love to take a view of that. All right, now continuing down the road with Joseph Smith and his taking many wives, there's an interesting occurrence which Oliver Cowdery actually was accusing Joseph Smith of adultery with a woman by the name of Fanny Alger. Now, Joseph Smith denied this entirely. He called Cowdery a liar, and you know, Cowdery was excommunicated for that as well as other crimes. But then, as you go back through the church records, you discover that Cowdery was right, that Fanny Alger was actually married to Joseph before that time.
Yeah, so Oliver Cowdery, one of the three witnesses, was pretty high up in Mormonism. You always hear about him in terms of three witnesses, and sometimes in their more honest times, the Mormons will tell you that Oliver Cowdery fell away. He got into an argument with Joseph Smith, and but they won't tell you what it's about. Often they don't know.
Yeah, well, I'm sure many don't know the fact that it was Oliver Cowdery accusing Joseph Smith of adultery. I mean, how often does that come up?
So he discovered Joseph Smith's plural wife activities. Joseph Smith obviously had not brought him into the inner circle and confided in him. So Joseph Smith was left with no other alternative than to deny the charge, right? Otherwise, he'd lose his standing as prophet.
Well, hell, Joseph Smith was practicing this long before it was supposedly given to him and long before it actually came out as one of these revelations.
Right. So it turns out Oliver Cowdery charges him with adultery. He denies it, Joseph Smith denies it, calls Oliver a liar, and he gets excommunicated.
Yeah, sounds perfectly reasonable to me. And interestingly enough, this is one of those underage ones. Of course, it wouldn't be underage back then. She was 16, so I'm sure that was marrying age back then.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking early 1800s. So it turns out, if you go to the wives of josephsmith.org, she's listed as number two. So it turns out Oliver Cowdery was not a liar. He was telling the truth. Joseph Smith was the one who was bending the truth and lying.
Yeah, now interestingly enough, this is the man that is supposed to be a prophet of God. He's the one that is always held up high for everybody to look at and everybody to aspire to be, and yet he lied so vehemently about something that was supposedly revelation that he got Oliver Cowdery excommunicated for it.
Now, to be fair, there is precedent for this. Abraham, going through Egypt, lied about Sarah, his wife. He said she was his sister, and that got the Pharaoh in a bunch of trouble. And apparently that lie was sanctioned by God. I mean, he didn't get in any trouble for it, right? Wow. Pharaoh got into trouble for believing the lie, trying to bring Sarah into his harem.
Well, I got to tell you, if God's saying don't lie, he's really loose with the truth, isn't he?
Well, in the Doctrine and Covenants, number 93, section 93, verse 30, all truth is independent in that sphere in which God has placed it, to act for itself as all intelligence also, otherwise there is no existence. So apparently God is loose with the truth. This is a revelation to Joseph Smith that your truth is kind of...
dependent upon the circumstances.
Yeah,
that's exactly what it says.
It's pretty much.
Are you kidding me? There is no black and white to truth. It's either truth or you're lying your ass off.
Yeah, there are. Yeah, I agree. There's, in some circumstances, I suppose there are shades of gray, but mostly it's black and white. So, for example, if your significant other says, "Do these jeans make my ass look fat?"
That's when you say, "No, your ass makes those jeans look full."
Right, or, you know, do I look fat in this dress or whatever? And you obviously say...
cottage cheese goes well with you.
Oh, God. you know, lies to spare people's feelings.
Yes, or to spare their feelings.
The classic philosophical argument is, for all those systems that say you absolutely cannot lie under any circumstances, this woman comes, she's bruised, she's battered, she's bleeding, her dress is torn... she comes pounding on your door and says, "My husband is trying to kill me. Can I hide here?" You say, "Absolutely. Go down to the basement and hide out." And a few minutes later, another pounding on the door, and there's her husband with this crazy look in his eye, and he's carrying an axe dripping with blood, and he says, "Have you seen my wife around?"
She's downstairs in the basement.
In that circumstance, it is both moral... and I think ethically obligatory. It is incumbent upon you to not only, you know, you don't say, "You haven't seen her." Shake your head. You don't do that. Better in that circumstance to say, "Yeah, she ran down the street.
Down
if you hurry, you can capture her."
I was trying to figure out what was going on, dude. I mean, you want me to help?
Yeah, you don't say, "Yeah, she's down in my basement. Have at her."
Yeah,
that's immoral.
In fact, could I get the video camera? This is going to be interesting.
In this case, this is a lie.
To
that
protect
is predicated
oneself.
On self-preservation. Absolutely. There's no other way that you can look at this. This is a self-protection lie, and that is immoral. In this case, you really ought to say, "Oliver, you're right. I was having sex with Fanny Alger. You walked in, whatever, however he found it.
Yeah.
Let me explain this doctrine to you. I know it looks bad.
But really, there's something behind this.
Especially since I haven't written the revelation down yet. I know it looks bad, but trust me, it's a revelation from God. And then take your lumps, but no.
I'd really like to see a picture of this Fanny Alger woman.
Well, her name's Fanny, so maybe she was...
a couple of hams. Well, all right, well, we've beaten the wife thing to within an inch of its life, so why don't we move on to something that... well, a quote from my dad is, he says to me, "The pearl of great price... is truly a great thing of wisdom."
This is funny because, you know, when the church split, when Joseph Smith died, and most of the Mormons went with Brigham Young, some of the Mormons went with what was called the reorganized
LDS
church.
Joseph Smith's son or something like that
right.
took over.
Emma Smith and that sort of thing, and Joseph Smith's son, Joseph Smith III. They formed the reorganized LDS church, and actually they still have... I think Doctrine and Covenants to this day, but they have repudiated both polygamy and the Pearl of Great Price. They do not believe that that is part of canon. It's still part of canon in Mormonism,
mainstream Mormonism, and I think they're right in denying that.
Absolutely,
I mean, they should deny everything, but you know, up to this point.
Yeah, they haven't gone far enough, right? Keep going, well, but because this Book of Abraham, this Book of Moses. Really, if you carefully look into it, there really is. Again, I said Adam God was fatal to Mormonism.
This is pretty damning.
This
right
was
here.
A nail in the coffin for me.
I mean, we're talking Joseph Smith takes Egyptian documents and states, well, actually he's kind of forced into it. The
so
people
let's,
run it to
yeah,
him.
Let's set this up. There was a traveling exhibit.
Man trying to sell off some trinkets for a rich
right.
man.
He was walking around like a carnival type thing, showing off the Egyptian mummies, and they had ancient papyri in there, and they had hieroglyphs. And at this point, again, the Egyptian hieroglyphs have not been fully cracked at this time. If
it's
anyone
still being
knows
worked
it,
on, actually.
It's at the highest level of academia. It's not certainly within the realm of Joseph Smith. Or
it hasn't even reached the Americas yet. This is still over in France.
Right. Right. I mean, this is a time where you would need prophetic intervention. To do this.
Perfect time for Joseph Smith to step up to the bat, and guess what his people said?
Well, sure, they said, "Look, you are a prophet of God, you have access to these translation stones, and you can translate ancient documents, so this would be a perfect
opportunity
for you to do this." And Joseph Smith kind of hemmed and hawed, and I think they finally dragged him to the exhibit, and he said, "This is not just Egyptian. This is the story of Abraham."
Yeah.
And so members of the church, again, Joseph Smith doesn't have any money, so members of the church got together, they put in a bunch of money, and they bought the mummies and the scrolls, the papyri that came with them.
Yeah, now, interestingly enough, after Joseph Smith translated these, and
translated, again, is in quotes.
Is in quotes, yes. He dies, and his wife actually has possession of them, and she glues them to a back of canvas, along with a letter certifying that these are truly the papyri that Joseph Smith translated as the Book of Abraham, and then she donated it to the museum.
Really? There's a letter certifying that?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's how, I mean, that was one of the things, is there was a letter certifying that this is Joseph Smith's papyri. Now, there was a problem in that scholars would have loved to get a hold of this, but there was a fire in the museum. And so the papyri were lost.
Yeah, up until 19-teens, I think, they thought that was it the Chicago fire that burned everything down?
Yeah.
They thought that it was
destroyed. Completely destroyed. And in fact, in 1912, the New York Times, they found a bunch of scrolls that actually matched what was scrawled in the back of the Book of Mormon.
And yeah, it was on the flip side of a painting of the Kirtland Temple, I think.
Let's get into that.
All right, go ahead. Go ahead.
All right, fine. We're getting up to this point. So in 1912, these papyri were still lost. They thought they were lost in a fire, and there was no way to verify what Joseph Smith said except from what was drawn in the back of the Book of Mormon. And so the New York Times actually went through the Metropolitan Museum and gauged them against what they had, and in fact, every Egyptologist there took one look at it and says, well, this has nothing to do with what Joseph Smith says it has to do. And not only that, but they were saying, well, this head here, this human head holding the knife, that should be the head of Anubis. And also, this hand here shouldn't be holding a knife, it should be holding an ankh. And the guy lying on the table, his hand shouldn't just be open there up in the air. He should be grabbing onto his phallus. This is actually just a regular old book of breathings.
And actually in the mid-1800s, because they copied these facsimiles in the newspaper, and eventually they made their way into the back of the Book of Mormon as the Pearl of Great Price, right, at the back of the Doctrine and Covenants.
Yeah.
So in the mid-1800s, they predicted that, no, this isn't a human head. As a matter of fact, it looks like this human head was copied from the guy lying down and just placed on...
Which it really is.
Like a wood carving,
if you look at it, definitely. Yeah, yeah.
So they said, there's probably a hole right here. It should be the head of the jackal. That should be Anubis, god of the dead and embalming, I think. And the guy, right, he shouldn't have his hands up here. He should be grasping his phallus. And Joseph Smith, if you look in this, and you can look it up on the internet, is this facsimile 2?
Facsimile number 1, I
number
believe.
Number 1? Yeah. The guy's lying on the table, and there's four jars underneath him, and there's a guy standing above him with a knife. And they said there's probably a hole right here with a knife, too, and there's probably a hole around the hands, because that's where these guys had to kind of freelance with their wood carving to get the facsimile.
Now, we'll actually have links on our site showing you where a lot of these images of the papyri are, so you can go and visit them.
Right. So Joseph translated this as Abraham... about to be sacrificed, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't even Isaac. It was Abraham on Pharaoh's table, I guess,
In fact, there was an angel that came down and saved him from that sacrifice, I believe.
And he gives these for the jars underneath, which are the canopic jars, which, if you know anything about Egyptology, that's where their organs are held, right? They take the organs out and they put them in the canopic jars, or the four sons of Horus. So he says these are four gods, and he gives these weird names for each of them
that
have no relation to anything that anyone knows about.
In fact, no
Egyptologist
has ever even heard of these names.
So it becomes very, very difficult, because they predicted this, and at this time...
They were still believed lost.
They were still believed lost. It's probably in the 1850s, 1860s. And they said, look, this is probably, they called it a lacuna, a hole in this area. And when they found them, lo and behold, there were holes right where they predicted them.
Not only were there holes, but you could see where Joseph Smith had drawn out the figures on the papyri. or excuse me, on the canvas behind the papyri. Yeah,
it's impressive.
So, I mean, it's just, it's fascinating that what the LDS Church did, because the university took these and they gave them back to the LDS Church. And then the LDS Church took them to Egyptologists and said, now we have this. We want you to translate them so we can prove that Joseph Smith is a prophet. And in fact, they were getting their little magazine ready for like a three-month showing of it.
They want to do a whole spread, right? Because Joseph Smith translations were about to be verified by the best of science. And here finally is a test, right?
Yeah.
We don't have the golden plates. No one ever had the golden plates.
No one ever.
You didn't even need them, and that's really disappointing, right? You're translating stuff with the seer stones. You don't even need the plates.
I mean,
this is ridiculous. No one has the golden plates. No one's really seen them. You have these testimony of the eight witnesses, which, you know, Martin Harris and Oliver Cowdery were taken out to a field, and they said that they actually beheld it with their spiritual eyes, but not their fleshly eyes. Which is a total cop-out.
Yeah, and in fact, one of them had to leave before they could all see it, and then Joseph Smith went to him directly and said, okay, we're going to kneel here and pray until you see it.
Exactly. And then they brought the other guy, so you'd repent for your sins and come back, and if you're forgiven, you'll see it. So what does the guy say? Of course I see it. So now we have the original source documents.
Yes, in 1970, what was it, 72, 73, they found it on the back of a painting. And so they took it to the church, and they said, well, here you go. And the church, like I said, they wanted this huge spread for it, and so they take it to these Egyptologists. Not a single Egyptologist would even verify what they wanted to say.
Yeah, one of the facsimiles was what's called a hypocephalus, which means below the head. And you place this, it almost looks like a plate or something, like a little dish, in a scroll, a circle that you put underneath the head. So it tells you, I think it was the Book of Breathings, where you kind of resurrect from the dead. You turn around and look at that. It tells you how to breathe again and what the next steps are to go into the afterlife. And curiously enough, Joseph Smith didn't get any of that right.
No, not only that, but Joseph Smith couldn't have even told you that the hypocephalus has a blank spot there, and it's very common. So when somebody dies, they had tons of these around. They would just scrawl in the guy's name and stick it under his head.
Right. It was big business back then. They'd get these scrolls and stuff, and you had really expensive ones for the pharaohs and nobility,
and then it just
really
went down and down. It's like buying a coffin.
Right, right. Fascinating stuff. Yeah. You know, when it's real.
When it's real.
This fake stuff really isn't interesting at all.
Well, it's somewhat entertaining.
How obvious and entertaining a fraud it is.
Now, the interesting thing is, these Egyptologists said, no, all this is a hypocephalus, everything is wrong here, and so what the LDS Church did is they took it to a BYU, an actual Mormon.
Yeah, that was John G., right?
Yeah. They take it to him. He's an Egyptologist, and they say, we would like you to translate these since no one else will. Obviously, everybody else was so wicked that they were trying to hide the fact that Joseph Smith was right. Well, this LDS Egyptologist took a look at it and said, I can't do it. This is exactly what they're saying this is.
You can't stay. I mean, even a Mormon Egyptologist cannot stake his academic credentials on backing up Joseph
Smith.
That
would be suicide professionally.
Because he's wrong. And if he was right, every Egyptologist would say, wow, I don't know how this happened, but here it is. He was accurate. And so what do Mormons say about it? Oh, well, these weren't the scrolls that Joseph Smith translated the Book of Abraham from. Hugh Nibley wrote like a 700-page book.
To bore the shit out of you so you wouldn't know what was said.
It's basically, his whole purpose is to, A, character assassinate the Egyptologist who said that this is such a joke. One of them said it's difficult to deal seriously with Joseph Smith's impudent fraud, right?
Yeah, no, this is the rest of it, though. This was Dr. Sace of Oxford University. The facsimile from the Book of Abraham number 2 is an ordinary hypocephalus, but the hieroglyphics upon it have been copied so ignorantly that hardly one of them is correct. I need scarcely say that Kolob are unknown to the Egyptian language. Smith has turned the goddess Isis into a king and Osiris into Abraham.
Absolutely amazing. And, you know, and the other one where he's sitting in there and Joseph Smith says that he's holding court for the Pharaoh and he's teaching the Pharaoh astronomy.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
oh, God,
the guy
astronomy?
he is he's teaching Egyptian astronomy.
Oh, you
my
gotta
God.
Be shitting me.
the guy he's identified as Abraham actually has the Pharaoh's hat. He's got the serpent and the vulture for
upper and lower Egypt.
And he's identified in the hieroglyphics right above his head as the Pharaoh. So, I mean, it's ridiculous. Unless the Pharaoh took his hat off and put it on Abraham, which, of course, I believe quite a few pharaohs would do.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure every time they had somebody so important, they would say, well,
here, sit on my throne.
This is the power that binds me to Egypt.
Wear
here, put
crown.
It on your head.
Yeah, it was the crown of Upper and Lower Egypt is never buried with any single pharaoh.
No.
They found Tutankhamun's tomb intact and no crown.
No crown.
The
this
theory
is a special
was
thing.
They kept refurbishing the crown. And that was the one thing that didn't go to you with the grave. It went to each different pharaoh. There was probably only one crown ever at any one time, anyway.
Now, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, to get
so
back on topic.
Something so precious, I'm sure they would have just popped on Abraham's.
Yeah, I'm sure Pharaoh was sitting there going, hey, I don't even like this hat. Put it on.
Not very important.
But anyway. So basically, after the church goes to this Egyptologist, the BYU Egyptologist, and he refuses, they bury it. In fact, what happened was...
Yeah, I think the only thing they did was they put a picture of it in the ensign.
Yeah, they put a picture, but they weren't even intending on it. In fact, what happened was, is a newspaper down here, I believe it was the Salt Lake Tribune, got a hold of these pictures, and they were going to print it. And what happens is this information was leaked to the church, and so the church got a hold of this, and decided they needed to get this out, otherwise it would look very bad on them. So they took the ensign and they stuffed it into the middle of this. And in fact, if you look at the page numbers, it's improperly numbered because they'll be talking about one thing and then, oops, look at all these hieroglyphics, and then they'll continue.
Oh, so it was such a last-minute decision that they had to stick it in there, I guess.
It was completely stuffed.
Anyway, this... 700-page book by Nibley. So he assassinates a character. You know, it's one chapter is an entire ad hominem for these Egyptologists, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure every single one of these with diverse backgrounds all have a personal axe to grind against Joseph Smith and Mormonism.
Oh yeah, they were all that evil.
Yeah, and the rest of the book is just an attempt at obfuscating the facts. It's more confusing than it is anything else. If they could get a single Egyptologist, even LDS. To agree with Joseph Smith's translation, the book would have been 5 pages long.
Yep. Look at this. This is what it says. We have proof. Now, the most amazing defense I've heard where Mormons are concerned, where this is them saying that although Joseph Smith was looking at this papyrus, he was spiritually translating what God wanted him to see.
Right. God works in mysterious ways. Again, that argument's only plausible if you're already Mormon. It's something you tell your Mormon friends who stumble upon this stuff.
Yeah.
Right? I've heard that, you know, Joseph Smith described it as hieroglyphs in the most beautiful red ink, and that none of the stuff that we recovered was red, and so therefore the Book of Abraham was translated off a different, still undiscovered scroll. How convenient. But Hugh Nibley, I think, compares in his book, the Book of Abraham, to like the Apocalypse of Abraham, and say, wow, there are all these similarities between these two documents. Hey, Hugh, the Apocalypse of Abraham was probably produced in the 2nd or 3rd century AD. It wasn't produced by Abraham himself or anywhere near. So comparing your Book of Abraham document, produced quite clearly in the 1830s, with something produced in the 2nd or 3rd century post-Christ, is a little disingenuous.
Yeah. Well, my biggest question is, why is God hiding himself from us so thoroughly? I mean, if Joseph Smith really was translating through spiritual eyes, why would God allow us to find these papyri again and then say, well, are you kidding me? This can't be true.
The whole thing's ridiculous. Is God all-powerful, or is he really powerful? Even if he's really powerful, he could have preserved these documents, the real documents from Abraham, across 2,000, 3,000 years. Hell, he did it with the Book of Mormon. Yeah. Why couldn't he have done it with the Book of Abraham?
Obviously, it wasn't on gold plates.
Yeah, clearly. you know, it's just ludicrous. The whole thing's ludicrous. I can't believe that anyone who looks into this stuff seriously can still buy it.
And that is the crux of the situation. How many of those LDS or converting actually dig into this information?
They don't. They buy the party line. Interestingly enough, with Adam Gott, which we're going to talk about next, it is so unknown now that people see it as an anti-Mormon argument.
Yeah.
It's false doctrine and blah, blah, blah. I remember talking to someone I knew at the University of Utah who's been a Mormon all his life, and I said that, well, you know, of course, that Brigham Young taught that Adam was our God and our father and the only one with whom we have to do, the literal father of Jesus Christ. No, that's ridiculous. He never taught that. Absolutely not. He placed a bet with me, and he never got back to me on that.
Yeah. In fact, I didn't even hear of the Adam God doctrine until my early 20s.
Yeah, it's in fundamentalist circles where I came from, it's very common because you only have a few prophets to draw from, right? You've got Joseph Smith, you got Brigham Young, John Taylor, and part of Wilford Woodruff. Past 1890, they declare that it's over. They can still be good men and receive visions like, I guess, Joseph Fielding Smith did. And
cast out spirits, yeah.
Yeah, that sort of thing. But they can't speak for God anymore. And the Adam God doctrine is so problematic that Hugh Nibley didn't even touch it. I mean, he wrote a 700-page book on the Book of Abraham, zero on the Adam God doctrine.
Well, it's, as we'll show you, it's indefensible. I mean, even this, I take a look at this, this is indefensible. I mean, Egyptologists saying, yeah, you're full of shit, that is indefensible in my opinion. But obviously, Hugh Nibley doesn't even think that Adam God is worth his 700 pages of boredom.
And here's the crux of the issue. With the Book of Abraham, you can close your eyes, plug your ears, nah, 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 I don't care what science says, I still believe. With Adam God, it's more problematic. It's your own prophet, and Mormons have this doctrine where when the prophet speaks to the church and he gives doctrine, it's infallible. He's just like the Pope. He can't be wrong.
Yeah,
the
Lord every word is gold.
Right, the Lord would never suffer the leader of church to lead the people astray. This is the final dispensation. That couldn't happen. So Joseph Smith says the identity of God is the first principle of the gospel, and I think Brigham Young said much the same thing. So if Brigham Young is wrong, if he's right that Adam is God, then the current church is wrong. You can't be Mormon because your church has fallen away. If he's wrong, well, Brigham Young led the church for 33 years. That was the longest any present prophet has held the office. So God sure took his time getting rid of him.
Yeah.
And then that whole time, if he was wrong, Brigham Young's praying to the wrong God. And he is giving priesthood through an idol, the wrong God. There is no priesthood power for those 33 years. It's gone. So nothing following Brigham Young can have priesthood. You're laying an axe to the root of the tree.
Yeah.
He's either right or he's wrong. Both ways you're screwed.
But we'll get into that next week. So thank you again for joining us, and we hope we didn't bore you to sleep and lose all of you. We hope we still have two.